You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Vladimir Putin, now in his third term as president of Russia, was handpicked to follow Boris Yeltsin. Although he was relatively unknown and has had little governmental experience, many hoped that he would turn out to be a progressive leader who would usher the country through its transformation from totalitarian state to democracy. But as you probably know, that didn't happen. In The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, Moscow-based journalist Masha Gessen gives an account of his rule, which has been marked by crackdowns on citizens' rights, suppression of the media, and the silencing of critics and potential opponents. Riverhead Books has just released a paperback edition of the book, and I'm very pleased that it brings Masha Gessen to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Did the two men know each other when Putin was named prime minister by Boris Yeltsin in 1999?
Putin had apparently been introduced to Yeltsin by people who had the brilliant idea of making him prime minister and making him the anointed descendant.
And what was Putin doing at the time? Did he have much of a political background?
Well, Putin was running the secret police. He was a highly placed bureaucrat. He had been a KGB agent his entire life. He after Perestroika, he got a job in Leningrad City Hall without stopping his KGB career. And he became deputy to the governor of St. Petersburg, which is where he served until 1996.
And did he have his sights on higher office at this point in his career?
I don't actually think so. I think he was very much married to the secret police. And I think he saw himself as acting in the shadows for the rest of his life.
Who were the small group of people who were looking for a new leader? You called them the family.
Right. I didn't invent that term. They were known as the family at the time. Yeltsin had become very isolated in his later years in office, and he was surrounded by people known as the family, including some of his actual family, who were his closest advisors and were believed to be running the country to a large extent.
And that included Boris Berezovsky.
It included Boris Berezovsky.
In retrospect, do you think that Berezovsky regrets that he voted for Putin?
You know, that's one of the most interesting aspects of that story, is that I think that Berezovsky still thinks it was a brilliant idea. He sort of regrets that it went wrong. But when he talks to me, and I've talked to him about this several times, when he talks to me about the plan to make Putin president, every time he's taken with what a great plan it was and how brilliantly he came up with it.
And why was the plan brilliant? Because the country was in chaos and they thought that perhaps someone from the KGB might be able to put things in order?
No, actually, the country was not in chaos. The country had been in chaos in the earlier 90s, but by the end of the 90s, it had really stabilized to a large extent, and the economy was growing, and the trains were running on time. But Yeltsin had become very isolated. He had a very strong opposition, and he had very real reason to fear that if he left office after his second term, which he had to do, he would be prosecuted for many of the things that had happened in the 90s. So he needed somebody who would guarantee his immunity from prosecution.
Prosecuted because of the way things had been handed over to the oligarchs, including people in the KGB. Didn't many of them benefit from that transition?
Most of them benefited, actually, from the redistribution of resources under Putin. But Yeltsin ruled the country by decree. Sometimes legally and sometimes quasi-legally, and I think had good reason to fear.
Just a month into Putin's term as acting president after Yeltsin resigned, a journalist interviewing Putin asked him about a reporter who was missing, Andrei Babitsky. Can you tell us what happened to him?
Andrei Babitsky was a Radio Liberty reporter in Chechnya. He was very well known, and he disappeared.
Radio Liberty meaning working for the United States?
Yes, Radio Liberty is a nonprofit corporation that's funded by an act of Congress, and Andrei Babitsky was a reporter in Chechnya. He disappeared. After a few days, it was discovered that he was actually being held in a Russian jail in Chechnya. And then things went really bizarre. He disappeared again. He was apparently handed over to the Chechen rebels, and he was held for several weeks. And it seems that there was every reason to fear that Babitsky would be disappeared completely. And I think the reason it didn't happen was partly because of the very strong international reaction, which Putin had not counted on, strong statements from the U.S. State Department, and some of the media attention in Russia as well, but mostly the international reaction.
So what does this event reveal about Putin? Did he have a direct involvement?
It appears that he was directly involved. It appears that this might have happened on his orders, and if it didn't happen on his orders, he at least had direct personal knowledge, which is what he revealed in that interview to that journalist.
Well, but he also kind of suggested that he had negative feelings not only about Babitsky, but about the media in general.
Absolutely. He thought that Babitsky was fit to be punished because he was a journalist who dared criticize the way that the Russian state conducted its war in Chechnya, and journalists shouldn't be doing that.
Well, what was the reaction of the Russian people? They had just come out of a period where there was censorship and repression, and I think they were assuming that things were going to get better, and this sounded very much like the sort of thing that would have happened in the past.
The Russian people, not unlike the international public, took a long time to catch on to what Putin was doing. And basically the entire takeover of state television, the entire takeover of federal television by the state, which took a year, Putin's first year in office, took place largely out of the public eye. I mean, there were protests, and the journalists themselves were very vocal about it, but it still involved a very small group of people.
And as we go on, we'll hear about more journalists who were endangered and who died. And you live in Moscow. You wrote this book. Is that a problem?
Is it a problem for
Well,
me?
I mean, do you fear that someday Putin is going to know what you wrote in this book and get upset with you?
I have a dangerous profession, and I live in a dangerous place. Russia has one of the highest rates of journalist murders in the world, and the highest of any country in peacetime, and the highest rate of murders that go uninvestigated and unpunished. At the same time, it's my home, and I'm not planning to leave. I think it should leave.
My guest is Masha Gessen, G-E-S-S-E-N. Her book, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, now available in paperback. Why did you call it The Man Without a Face?
That refers to the way that Putin was picked by that small group that we called the family. They had a lineup of faceless bureaucrats that they were choosing from. Because anybody who had actual political ambition and clout had been alienated by Yeltsin and had gone over to the opposition. So they needed to sort of invent somebody, supply him with a biography, supply him with a backstory, very much in the KGB fashion. And they were looking at several people who were equally sort of gray and faceless.
So after he comes to power, there's a string of damaging explosions in Russia occurred right after he was named prime minister. Can you talk about the investigation into those bombings and who ended up being behind them, at least as far as the rest of the world understands?
Right. Yeah, more than 300 people were killed and more than 1,000 were injured in a series of three apartment block explosions that happened in late August, early September of 1999. The explosions were never properly investigated by the Russian police and the Russian courts. There were some independent investigation attempts that were foiled. And this is part of the problem of doing investigative journalism in Russia, is that you can't rely on the normal work of law enforcement.
You can't go to the cops and say, what's going on here?
Right. And you can't look at their investigation. You can't look at the court records and you can't look at the court decisions. So a lot of that's why in the book I often use the words it appears. So it appears that the secret police was behind the bombings.
Well, who are they blaming it on?
They were blaming them on Chechen rebels.
So is this one of those situations where you fake you explode, do these terrible terrorist acts, and then blame it on somebody who you want to punish, even though you've really done it? It's like the Reichstag fire.
Absolutely. It looks like it was planned to create incredible popular support for whoever Yeltsin had chosen as his successor, and that's exactly what happened.
And then was there a crackdown afterward?
There was something of a crackdown. I mean, there was a series, actually, of terrorist acts during Putin's early years in office, each of which was then used to justify another crackdown and another step in the destruction of the electoral system and the media.
He's from St. Petersburg, formerly Leningrad, which was a very poor city when he was born in 1952. Did he have a tough childhood?
He did, like other kids who grew up in that city at that time. But I think that, yeah, his very scrappy, very difficult, very hungry, very sort of feral childhood has had a significant impact on him.
Did he grow up wanting to be a KGB agent?
Yes, he did. I believe that he was actually born into the KGB. It appears that his father was a KGB agent. It appears that because of this, they were slightly privileged, slightly by Soviet standards. So they had a larger room than their neighbors in the communal apartment. They actually had a phone of their own, which is very unusual. Putin had a wristwatch as a schoolboy, which was also highly unusual. And yeah, he idolized the KGB, and from the time he was a schoolboy, he wanted to work there.
And then he joined in the 1970s. What was its culture like? This is post-Khrushchev, isn't it?
This is the Brezhnev era, and this is the final stages, sort of the agony of the KGB, actually, because the KGB by that point had become unbelievably vast and unbelievably dysfunctional. It collected incredible amounts of information that it didn't have the resources to process. So a lot of people who didn't quite understand what the point of their work was collecting press clippings and writing endless reports and all of that going into rooms stuffed with paper that nobody would ever look at.
And how did Putin fare in this environment?
He basically became another paper pusher. But I think another important thing about the KGB culture of the 70s and 80s is that this was a period when there were no real external enemies. They weren't looking for spies. They weren't looking for a way to protect the country from an external enemy. What they really did was focus on the dissidents. That was the big enemy of the state as far as they were concerned.
And the state was kind of falling apart, and that's why Gorbachev was named leader in 1985, and then he did the unthinkable. He initiated perestroika, restructuring, and glasnost, openness to modernize the Soviet Union in his hopes of saving the Soviet Union. How did the KGB and Putin react to those changes?
The KGB, I think, was very resentful, most of the KGB.
Because they felt it would take some power away from them?
Because it was taking power away from them. Furthermore, the KGB attempted a coup in August 1991. The coup failed, and the Soviet Union fell apart as a consequence. But the KGB was, of course, extremely resistant to reforms. But Putin, in particular, was in East Germany at the time. So he watched this from afar. And I think it's important to realize that he didn't even see the mood that the country was in, the incredible boost or morale that perestroika created.
Is that why the coup failed? Because the KGB still had a lot of power.
The KGB probably had less power than it imagined. And it also, as I said, was highly dysfunctional. It couldn't make things work.
Well, but Putin worked for a man named Anatoly Sobchak, who was a pro-democracy politician, the chair of the Leningrad City Council. So did he have pro-democracy leanings at this point?
I think Sobchak is a complicated person. I mean, I don't write about him in the book that much, but I think that his reputation as a Democrat is an oversimplification and an exaggeration.
What was Putin's role in the government of Leningrad? He was criticized by a woman named Marina Salyer, who was also in Leningrad politics, and she left politics completely, moved out of the city. Is it because of Putin?
She moved out to the countryside, actually into the woods, and spent 10 years there until her death last year because someone had scared her very, very badly. She would never tell me who the person was and what the threat was. But she knew she was in enough danger to need to get out. This happened after she tried to publicize the results of her 1990s investigation into Putin's corrupt activities as a member of the St. Petersburg government. And she was trying to do this as he was running for office as president.
My guest is Masha Gessen, a journalist and director of the Russian arm of Radio Liberty. She has written several books, contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, The New York Times, Granta, and Slate, among other publications. And her book, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, has just been made available in a paperback edition by Riverhead Press. Stay with us for more. We are back with Masha Gessen. She's written a book called The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, now available in a paperback edition from Riverhead Books. And it clears up a lot of stuff because I, like so many Americans who are interested in what goes on in Russia, have followed this story largely through the newspapers. But we don't get the stories that kind of just follow the stories. For example, we were talking about Sobchak, who had a reputation for being a Democrat. You say perhaps he wasn't. He lost re-election in St. Petersburg and then fled to Paris and then returned to Russia. This is all very confusing to somebody who isn't privy to the kind of inner workings of Russian politics.
Right. Let me see if I can explain this in a minute or less.
And then he died.
He was investigated for corruption. He had every reason to fear that he would go to jail. I think the corruption charges against him were warranted. So he fled to Paris. It appears that Putin, who at this point was working in an administrative job in the Kremlin in Moscow, helped him escape. And then Sobchak returned when Putin became acting president because he felt safe. Whether he should have felt safe or not is an open question, because then he became a campaigner for Putin. And then he started shooting off his mouth. He was never a very well-controlled man. So the stories he was telling about Putin's past were not exactly – they were complimentary to Putin, but they were not exactly the stories that Putin was telling. And then Sobchak died mysteriously. And there's a writer and former investigator who was living in Paris until recently who conducted an investigation of that death and came to the conclusion that Sobchak was probably poisoned.
And that was Anatoly Vaksberg.
That was Anatoly Vaksberg, whose car exploded in a Moscow parking garage while he was conducting this investigation.
So it's dangerous to say anything about Putin or to say anything about the people who have been close to Putin.
It has been deadly for some people.
In 2001, the Russian submarine, the Kursk, sunk in the Barents Sea, and all 118 men on board died. You call this a metaphor for the post-Soviet state. Can you explain?
It was this huge Soviet submarine, as big as the superpower ambition. And it had fallen into disrepair over a decade. It was apparently armed with supplies that hadn't been properly stored. So it may actually have been an explosion that was caused by the improper storage of explosives on the submarine. Then after the submarine began sinking, some of the men died immediately, and some of them were actually in a safe part of the submarine and had been able to isolate themselves from the smoke and the effects of the explosion.
Other countries offered to help.
Other countries offered to help, and Russia wouldn't let them into its territorial waters. Furthermore, there was a large battleship that was near the place where the submarine sank, which apparently ignored the fact that the submarine had sunk and left the scene. The way that the whole sort of thing fell into disarray and the way that these men died as a result of neglect and inaction, it's not even clear that any bureaucrat made an active decision not to let the countries in. Nobody just made the decision to let them help.
Well, do we know Putin's role in all of this?
Putin played a non-role. And I think this is a very significant point in his presidency. He'd been president for less than a year at this point. He was on vacation. He did not decide to stop his vacation. He did not fly to the scene of the disaster for days afterward. And the way he explained it was that if there were too many officials around, it would get in the way. And it was very clear that he perceived himself as a bureaucrat, not as a leader.
But you would think that we're seeing problems pile up and there are more to come, you'd think that that would hurt somebody as the leader of a country. He was reelected and probably would have been reelected a third time if the Russian Constitution had prevented him from running as president. Now he's president again.
Now he's president again after taking a break for 4 years and then getting reelected for a new 6-year term. it's longer now. His last election was fixed, and it was fixed in significant ways. I think that in past years, he would have won even if he hadn't fixed the elections, which he had.
Despite all of these things, because the next big crisis is the attack on the school in Beslan.
Right.
Also something that might have hurt most leaders.
Right. Something like the attack on the school in Beslan, something that shocks the entire population of the country and that makes everybody fear for their safety and the safety of their children, actually tends to be good for incumbents. That does not tend to bring leaders down, especially authoritarian leaders.
But it was handled so poorly.
It was an absolute disaster. There were two competing rescue efforts. It appears that at some point they might have been shooting at each other. And then, of course, they destroyed the school at point-blank range, killing many of the children in the school.
The hostages. And I've seen a documentary about that. The parents all blamed the government. They were angrier with the government than they were with the hostage takers.
Right, but this was 3 years into Putin's presidency, and at this point, the information infrastructure of Russia had been destroyed. The media had been taken over by the state, and the electoral system had been essentially destroyed. So the fact that some people in a small town, far away from major cities, were very upset with the government did not affect anybody but that very small group of people.
My guess is Masha Gessen, her book, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, it's now available in paperback from Riverhead Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And then in November 2006, an FSB officer, that's the secret police that replaced the KGB, named Alexander Litvinenko, died in London after he was poisoned with polonium. How was Putin connected to Litvinenko?
Litvinenko was an FSB whistleblower, sort of a classic whistleblower, who had tried to go to Putin when Putin first became head of the FSB, tried to draw his attention to illegal activity and corruption within the FSB, got no response, then was arrested. Because this was still the Yeltsin period. He was actually eventually released and was able to flee the country because he had every reason to fear being arrested again. He settled in London, where he was a consultant and also an active writer. He wrote many columns criticizing Putin and criticizing him very personally in ways that were probably quite painful for Putin if he read those columns. Putin,
But they would be better known in the West than they would have been in Russia. You're saying that the media in Russia pretty much was controlled by this time.
The national media were controlled. His columns came out on the internet. I wouldn't say that they were widely read in Russia, but it appears they were probably read by Putin. This was before people got too scared to tell him about bad things that had been written about him. So his friends believed that he was probably killed as a result of those columns that were personally insulting to Putin, because Putin is known to be an extremely personally vengeful person.
And that case continues to this day. There is an alleged killer, and Britain has asked for him to be extradited, and Russia won't do it.
Not only will Russia not do it, Russia has arranged for him to become a member of parliament so that he has immunity from prosecution even in Russia. And there is an inquest going on in London right now into the death of Litvinenko, but Russia is not cooperating.
Then we come to the case of the journalist Anna Politkovskaya, who ended up with some of the documents that Litvinenko leaked, and she was also poisoned and then survived.
She was poisoned on her way to Beslan. This is actually two of the most prominent journalists who tried to go to Beslan to cover that tragedy were Anna Politkovskaya and Andrei Babitsky, whom you also mentioned earlier, who had been taken hostage a couple of years before. Both of them were taken off their flights. And then when Politkovskaya eventually managed to board another plane going to a different city from where she was going to drive 400 kilometers to Beslan, she was poisoned on the plane. And by the time she was taken off the plane, she was near death, survived almost miraculously.
She found out that a man had warned the police hours before the attack in Beslan, and nothing had been done.
That's correct. She found that out later.
Now, was it in the best interest of Putin for the attack to go on, to be allowed?
That's a great question.
Or was it just incompetence?
I think it was incompetence. I think it was, it was dysfunctionality.
Because there are people who believe the secret police were behind that attack as well, or encouraged it.
There are people who believe that. I have seen no evidence of it. But what I think is important about this attack is that it became clear that by the time the attack was actually underway, the FSB made every effort to maximize the number of casualties, to maximize the bloodshed. And I think in that sense, the FSB is always working in concert with the terrorists. Both of them have it in their interests to scare as many people as possible.
Also, doesn't it give the Russian government carte blanche to go after people they claim are terrorists? Well, they did this in Beslan. They set up some explosions in another place. Let's kill as many of them in Chechnya as we can.
Exactly. That was the war in Chechnya was still going on at the time, and those kinds of terrorist attacks were used to drum up public support for it.
So Anna Politkovskaya survived the poisoning, although she had received a number of death threats, and then she was shot and killed in 2006. Do we know who shot her?
People have been tried, and some are being prosecuted for her murder. But no, we don't know who shot her. We don't know who ordered the killing, even if we do find out who shot her. There's no trust in the investigation, so even if somebody is convicted, that will not solve the murder. But I think that unlike the death of Litvinenko, where there's a smoking gun pointing at the Kremlin, there's no such thing in Politkovskaya's murder. There were many people who would have wanted her dead. But I think that what's important about Putin's Russia is that it's the kind of country where people like Politkovskaya, whom many people want dead because she's a controversial and brave journalist, can be killed with impunity. That's the country Putin has created.
So what has that meant for the quality of journalism in Russia these days? Are people self-censoring?
People are self-censoring. People are being directly censored by the government, depending on where they work. And it's turned the media into a very polemical space. There's too little reporting, there's too little opportunity for reporting, and there's too much discussion on a very narrow range of topics. It dumbs journalism down in the worst way.
And then the oligarchs aren't safe either. Some of them thought that they were protected by all the money that they had, but we come to the case of Mikhail Khodorkovsky. One of the richest men in Russia, who's currently in prison.
Has been in prison for more than 9 years, and I think will be in prison as long as Putin is in office.
Because even when his sentence seemed to be coming to an end, they just added on how many years?
They added on, I think, 8 years. And the second crime set of crimes that he was charged with amounted to his having stolen oil from himself.
So what were the original charges? Were they just simply insulted Putin to his face, challenged him too many times, supported opposition candidates?
He did all of those things, and for that he was charged with tax evasion and embezzlement. The tax evasion charges may or may not have had some grounds for them, but it was a clear case of selective enforcement and improper court procedure.
Then there's the more recent incident with Pussy Riot, the rock group. Some of their members have been sentenced to prison again for performing at a political protest in a Russian Orthodox cathedral. Is this Putin trying to make the church happy, or is this again just a political thing?
It's actually a personal thing. They performed a 40-second song in the Cathedral of Christ the Savior, and the words of the song were, "Mother of God, drive Putin out." And I think that this is a case where personal insult has led to 2 years of imprisonment.
Have you ever spoken to Putin?
I have spoken to Putin, yes, after I read the book.
That's after you were also fired from a job?
Right. I was fired from a job as editor of a popular science magazine for refusing to cover Putin's hang gliding with the Siberian cranes.
Which many people consider to be an outrageous joke. So earlier this year, he ordered a major change in the rules of parliamentary elections, which could help solidify his power. How are those kinds of changes greeted in Russia?
At this point, they're seen as irrelevant. The parliamentary election in December 2011, which was very clearly fixed, led to an unprecedented rise in protests and basically to almost a year of very, very large street protests. But it's not a change of procedure. It's a general sense that the people in Russia want to have good government and want their government to provide decent services and to be open and honest.
Is there anyone who challenges him? For a time, it was thought that the man, his hand-picked man, Dmitry Medvedev, would actually be a serious challenger to him, but that doesn't seem to have happened.
I think that was a lovely fantasy that was based on almost nothing.
So what was your conversation with him like?
It was bizarre. It was probably the most bizarre thing that's ever happened to me. He called me in to say that I shouldn't have been fired, that I should have sent a reporter, but that firing me was going overboard, even though there should be discipline at a magazine like there is in an army. And then he forced the publisher to offer me my job back. And I said, no, I don't think I can be appointed to my job as editor by Putin, even though I had loved that job.
Well, we are grateful to you for telling us so much about Putin. There's a lot more in this book, obviously, we couldn't get to. But Masha Gessen's book is called The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, now available in a paperback edition from Riverhead Books. And I thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.